Madam Clerk, can you call the roll?
Councilmember Best?
Here.
Councilmember Combs?
Here.
Councilmember DeVries?
Here.
Councilmember Erby?
Here.
Councilmember Hanson?
Here.
Deputy Mayor Carrington?
Here.
The mayor will be here in about 15 minutes, and there is a quorum.
Okay. Mr. Erby, can I have you lead us in the pledge?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Now there's a chance for audience participation. If anyone wants to come forward to speak to the council for general matters. Okay, seeing no one come forward. New business. We'll entertain a motion to go into a committee as a whole. Okay, moved by Councilwoman Combs, seconded by Councilman Best. Okay, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay, we're in the committee as a whole. Mr. Manager.
And Mayor and Council, can I ask that we have our Finance Director, Esther Green, come and introduce the auditor for tonight's presentation?
For tonight's 2013 audit, Michelle Drew will be coming to present the audit, and she is the auditing partner for the City of Palmer. And I present you Michelle Drew.
Welcome.
Thank you. Good evening, everyone. You probably don't want me to say good evening, Madam Mayor, so I'll try not to do that. First of all, let me just say thank you for having me here tonight. I think you are all aware, but in case you're not, I'm just going to take one quick minute and do a quick intro. As Esther said, my name is Michelle Drew, and I am a partner with BDO. And for those of you who were here last year, I introduced myself as a partner with Macunda Cottrell. And so the good news, the bad news is, in 2013, Macunda Cottrell was sold, effectively sold to BDO, which is a national CPA firm. The good news for me, for that purpose, of course, is it allows us to have a bigger infrastructure, resources, and boots on the ground in other locations where many of our other clients have spread to. But for you as the City of Palmer, that may not be as big of an issue. So I also feel compelled to report back that, you know, we're still wholly committed to Alaska, and we're still wholly committed to retaining our municipal government clients and trying to serve them in the best way possible. Many of the folks, there were four key audit folks who worked on the audit, including myself this year, and I believe three of those four were repeat from a prior year. So we were able to maintain continuity of staffing and to be able to have a little bit more of an efficient audit in that way. We do, of course, as I say in past years, as I've reported to you, ultimately my job is to report to you, the council. And so I do welcome you at any time. As I'm going through my presentation, please stop me if I'm unclear. Feel free to ask questions at any time. And not only tonight, my phone line is always open, and I am more than willing to answer questions. In fact, happy to do so throughout the year if that need should arise. So tonight we have two documents. The first, of course, I've historically kind of called the housekeeping document, which is called the audit wrap-up report. And it includes certain items that are essentially required under professional standards, items that are required to be communicated to you as the governing body so that you can perform your governance procedures. So I'm going to go through that really quickly and just hit some of the highlights, and then we'll walk through the financials right after that. So starting, it's actually page 3 under the status of our audit. Please keep in mind that as your external auditor, our goal is to provide a reasonable assurance that the financial statements are materially correct. We cannot provide absolute assurance. The only way to provide absolute assurance would be to do a 100% reperformance of your entire financial activity, which would be no fun for anyone and would be very, very cost prohibitive. We have issued an unmodified opinion, which is, if I had sat here last year, I would have said it was an unqualified opinion, which is still auditor speak. Don't ask me why the powers that be continue to change this lingo, but it is essentially a clean audit opinion, and it is from a standpoint of the financial statements are presented in accordance with GAAP. It's the best report card that you can get from an external auditor. All of the records that we requested were made available to us with excellent cooperation from not only the finance office, but the outlying departments as well, where needed. Everyone gave us access, their full cooperation, and very forthcoming with information, so we very much appreciate everyone's cooperation. Over on the next page 4, the city did not adopt any new GASB pronouncements. As you know, GASB is the regulatory body that governs accounting process and procedure for governmental entities. This is like the first and only year that I'm going to say the city did not adopt any new accounting procedures because the GASB is on overdrive and they are cranking out new rules almost every single year. To our knowledge, no significant changes in accounting policies, processes, procedures, things. And there may have been some tweaking here and there, but by and large, processes were status quo. Financial information does include inherently certain accounting estimates. Now, the city of Palmer isn't in a position where you have lots and lots of highly complex estimates, but you do have some estimates included in your financial statements. For example, whether or not an accounts receivable is deemed to be collectible or not, the estimated lives of your capital assets and infrastructure, and in other contingency type items, specifically litigation related or other possible unknown payouts. To our knowledge, there were no significant changes to the process for estimations this year, and we did not identify any transactions that were unusual or significant or for which there was no, you know, actual accounting rule where we really had to make up our own rules, so nothing like that. Over on page 5, corrected and uncorrected misstatements, there were 13 audit adjustments from the time we were given the trial balance to the ending financial statement report. 9 of those were considered significant. However, I am compelled to report to you that those were not the auditors found this problem. They were issues that the finance office had identified as this is wrong, this is the entry we think to correct it. We want you to look at it before we actually post the entry to ensure that it gets in correct the first time. So there were 9 of those items. Those journal entries themselves are actually included in the management representation letter, which is the very last kind of page of this particular document if you're interested in to see what the actual adjustments were. To our knowledge, all proposed entries were corrected. That is to say, the accounting and professional standards do allow us to pass on adjustments if we find something that's wrong, but we don't believe that it materially misstates. We are allowed to not record it. However, it's just easier if we find it. If it's wrong, let's fix it and move on. So to our knowledge, there were no uncorrected misstatements in the financial statements. Over on the next page, we have internal control over financial reporting. And the very last sentence on page 6 says, in conjunction with our audit of the financial statements, we reported no material weaknesses. Professional standards prohibit me from saying to you, we did not identify any significant deficiencies. However, had we identified any significant deficiencies, those would be mandated to be in writing. You figure it out. You figure that out. And then over on page 7, just a few other required communications. No significant changes to the audit plan. We do planning at the outset, determine what we're going to test, follow the plan. To the extent we find problems or errors, we'll adjust the audit plan accordingly. But really, other than those specific entries that were identified primarily, again, by management, not a lot of surprises during the audit. Nothing came to our attention regarding possible legal violations, material misstatements, no fraud allegations. We're not aware that management has opinion shopped with other CPA firms or other accountants or consultants. And really, we had no disagreements with management, regardless of whether they were satisfactorily resolved. Just basically, if we found a problem, we discussed it. That's it. No significant difficulties, and again, we really appreciate everyone's cooperation and preparation, and particularly, again, the finance office in keeping the books and records in pretty good working order and getting ready for us to do what we need to do. So that's kind of the housekeeping side of things. And then the financial statements themselves, I'm going to just kind of start on page one. And page one is the independent auditor's report. Again, just a quick point out, the audit is a clean audit opinion, and the actual opinion itself actually lives on page two. And then over on page three, the very last paragraph where it calls out government auditing standards, you are a local government, the city is the recipient of state and federal dollars, and as a recipient and spender of state and federal dollars, you are required to follow government. We're required to conduct the audit in accordance with government auditing standards, which is just a little bit step more complex than a regular just financial statement audit. And it does include the review of your grants and contract compliance and legal provisions and internal controls regarding same. Over on page seven, we have the management's discussion and analysis. And I'm not going to go through this in grave detail other than just to say, for those of you who are not accountants and who don't love spreadsheets and rows and columns of numbers, this is that high-level narrative where you can kind of just read it, and it not only explains, oh, these are the numbers that flowed through, but it really does try to explain some of the why and what some of the changes were from the prior year to the current year. I strongly encourage you to review that if you get a chance to do that. There's a lot of information in there. The actual financial statements begin on page 20 and 21. And page 20 and 21 are the best page in the whole report for the purpose of, at a glance, what happened. These are what we call in the business the GASB 34 or the government-wide financial statements. And these two pages aggregate all of the activity for the city onto these two pages. Now, this is not the way that you manage on a day-to-day basis. It's not the way, it doesn't speak to budget. It's not on a budgetary basis. It doesn't break out the individual funds. What it does do, though, is it aggregates everything together at a very, very high level, so you can just kind of see in a nutshell where things landed. On the balance sheet side, which is page 20, the only thing I'm going to say about this is it's very, very consistent with the prior year. There are very minimal nominal swings at all by category. It was a pretty stable across the board year on the balance sheet side. On the income statement side, which is on page 21, the two columns, the last three columns of the page, and specifically the two columns where it says governmental activities and business type activities, the purpose of those two columns is actually to show you the extent to which costs were incurred in the first column, and then program revenues supported those costs. And for program revenues, we're specifically talking about your fees, fines, and user charges, as well as your operating grants that are dedicated operating grants, for example, public safety grants versus general fund, undedicated type grants, and your capital grants and contributions. So in the governmental governmental activities column, and in the business type column, what you see there are negative numbers. And what that tells you is the degree to which your expenditures have to be funded either through your tax base or through other non-restricted revenue sources. For almost every single city that I audit, when you look in the governmental activities column, you will see huge negatives because your general fund is by definition funded through your tax base most of the time. So it's very, very common to see negatives in that category. On the business type activities column, what we want to see is smaller and smaller and smaller negatives here to see that the users of those specific charges are covering the cost of that service. That having been said, keep in mind this is a long-term perspective, what we call a full accrual basis, and it does include those long-term activities, including depreciation. And again, in Alaska, there's a huge raging debate, in fact, statewide, whether or not it's reasonable or even whether it's reasonable that user charges should be able to cover the cost of depreciation of infrastructure that those users didn't pay for in the first place. I'm not making any commentary on that. What I am saying is the user charges are not covering the full cost of services, even in your business type activities. However, that all having been said, at the end of the day, bringing in your taxes, bringing in those non-specific revenue streams, across the board, the overall change in net position was a decrease of $636,000 on a $10 million operating budget. That's not a very huge swing. And keeping in mind that does include a fair amount of depreciation, which we'll talk about in a minute. So the next page I'm actually going to talk about, actually we're going to start at page, we're going to kind of bypass the notes and some of the non-major fund roll-up schedules, and we're going to go to page 64. Again, I would strongly encourage you to read the footnotes. There's a huge amount of information, a wealth of information rolling within the footnotes that you might or might not gather from just looking at the face of the financial statements. But I'm going to, again, kind of just hit the highlights and keep this high level and hopefully allow enough time for questions on your end. So page 64 is the general fund. Now, this section of the financial statements, this is the way you manage on a day-to-day basis. So it is on what we call the governmental or modified accrual basis. So the governmental income statement, which starts on page 65, is on your budgetary basis, not full accrual, no depreciation. Long-term debt is an expense item rather than a balance sheet item. So on the balance sheet side, the cash and investment account, and you can have comparison prior year to current year, there really aren't any. Again, it was a pretty stable, relatively stable year, not any really big swings from 2012 to 2013. On the assets, you know, assets went up a little bit. The cash and investment accounts represent about 41% of the total assets. So that's a pretty strong, solid percentage of liquid spendable cash to maintain and run your day-to-day operations. The biggest item of interest, I think, on the general fund for the balance sheet, of course, is the advance to other funds. And if you look at that in a comparative, 2012 was $226,000, and then for 2013, it swung way high to $756,000. So what happened? Well, what actually happened was kind of a judgment in philosophy, because if you look at the item right above the advance, that item is due from other funds. And in auditor lingo, a due from other funds and advance to other funds, the difference is long-term and short-term. But otherwise, without regard to the long-term and short-term, what they both mean are that some other fund has borrowed money from the central treasury more than it had. It borrowed more than it had a right to receive. In 2012, you can see the due from other funds was $443,000. And it was decided at the 2013 audit, it really was decided that, you know, the reality is that short term, which the bulk of which is from the airport, and that's roughly $500,000 of it. And then the remainder of it is from the golf course fund, about $240,000. But the big swing was that the airport was deemed not to be current, because realistically, the airport is not going to be able to liquidate that due from other funds in the immediate short term.
You've got that backwards. The golf course is one that has the 500,000.
I'm sorry. I said that backwards. The golf course is 500, and my notes are upside down. And the airport is 240. My apologies. The other item that's... Sorry.
So, can I go back to page 21?
Sure.
So when you say do other funds, or, you know, another fund owes the general fund money, how come that doesn't show on the business type activities on page 21? How come that doesn't show as a governmental support for airport or golf course in the, which would be the 1-2-3rd paragraph?
That's an excellent question. If you look on page 20, and you go up to the asset section, okay. And there's a category there called internal balances. Okay. So what's going on with this is and the numbers don't exactly match the general fund because there's more than just there's short terms going on in here as well as the long term, but they're living in this. Right now, what has been said to date is that this fund owes that fund, but it isn't reflected on the income statement because the council has not authorized, the budget hasn't approved an actual a forgiveness of that debt or a subsidy or a transfer in any way. That's why it doesn't show up on page 21. At this time, the general fund, which is reflected in this governmental activities column, is calling it a receivable. And the offsetting fund, the airport and or the golf course fund, are calling it a payable, much like a long-term debt or long-term receivable or long-term payable. So at this juncture, as of the cutoff, 12/31/2013, the expectation is, although it was reclassified from what was considered a quote-unquote short-term borrowing from the central treasury to a long-term borrowing based on the fact that it doesn't have an immediate ability to pay it back, there was no judgment being made that it has no ability to pay it back or that a plan can't or shouldn't be put in place to pay it back at some point in the future.
So, I understand what you're saying, but I thought the long term was to be reflected on this. It's just the either one. If there's a plan to pay it back, there's intentions to pay it back, then neither of those would be on page 21.
Right. It would not be reflected on page 21, unless or until it was actually forgiven and or paid. And basically, if it's paid off, it will never be reflected on page 21. If any one of those funds actually pays it back, it won't flow through the income statement. It would just be we're going to reduce the receivable and we're going to reduce the payable and we're going to transfer the cash, but it doesn't actually affect income.
It just doesn't make any sense when you're trying to see how much revenue, you know, you're showing how much revenue the general fund supported for different activities, and there's nothing in there, even though they subsidize those activities. There's no reflection on this page that you love the most. I don't love the page the most if it doesn't show me where all the revenue that is received is goes. So I'm going to have to look for a different page to like a lot. So.
Okay. And just to be clear, I actually don't love this page either, but there's just a lot of information on it. Yeah. Okay, sorry. Okay, so back to page 65. Sorry. Oh, it's page 64. The other kind of big ticket item on the general fund balance sheet is, of course, the deferred. If you look at the unearned revenue in the liability section, there's quite a big jump from 2012 to 2013. And that basically, the bulk of that $600,000 account is actually the Matsuburo. You have a contract with the Matsuburo for dispatch services. And typically, they would pay that in January for FY14. They actually cut the check in December. You received the check in December, but it's for services that you will be rendering in calendar 14. So that number will get pushed to the income statement, and it will run through revenue in 2014. It also included a fire service grant and a few other odds and ends.
I have another question.
Councilmember Hanson.
Okay, so under assessments, are you the person to ask why these figures are different, or is the finance people the people to ask?
I'm sorry, one more time?
Under assessments, you have deferred. Is that because we booked a new Bonanza in a couple new streets? Is that why we have more deferred there? Okay.
Yeah.
And delinquents went up $50,000.
Delinquents? Oh, in the upper section, you mean?
Yeah.
The current assessment was 33 and 12 and went to 39, so it went up a little bit, the current portion. That's the amount that we'll get billed in 2014. The delinquents are the...
Deferred.
The delinquents are the people who are in arrears that haven't paid, that have been billed but didn't pay.
Okay,
and so that actually went down, which means somebody did pay. Somebody who was delinquent actually did pay. And then the deferred is the portion that will be billed in a subsequent year.
Okay, I must have been looking at it cross. I had those.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I saw those numbers as just opposite of that. So
okay,
I'm good.
Okay, all right. And then the last thing, fund balance. The last thing on page 64 is fund balance. And what you can see, what we have done, fund balance is reported in five categories: non-spendable, restricted, committed, assigned, and unassigned, based on specific accounting definitions. Non-spendable means it's held, it's equity and you own it, but it isn't in a spendable form. Specifically, prepaid items, prepaid rent, those items are not cash spendable. We paid the prepaid item, we paid the item, it will get expensed in the subsequent year. And then the other thing is those advances. Because as I already mentioned, there's no immediate plan or ability immediate to pay it back. Therefore, we want to make sure we carve that out of fund balance so it doesn't look like we're over-reporting fund balance in the general fund for funds that we may or may not get back at some point in the immediate near term. So the unassigned fund balance actually is the amount that you have available for appropriation, as it were, $1.2 million. And based on your 2013 budget level, that amount approximates about 1.5 months, about 1.5 months of general fund operations. Acknowledging that it's not a perfect science and you don't spend money exactly in equal installments every month, but it's roughly 1.5 months. GFOA, the Government Finance Officers Association of America, actually recommends that number be in a range from 3 to 6 months. So you're definitely, you know, kind of outside of that range, but it's certainly, you are in the positive, you are in the black, and not in a negative position at this point. Going over to page 65, we get into the income statement, budget and actual for the general fund. Revenues, the taxes actually make up about 64% of your total revenue in the general fund. And then your intergovernmental, which is primarily your grants, makes up about 11% of the total revenue stream. If you look budget to actual, pretty much you have a few little categories that actually came in under budget or received less than you anticipated. And some you received less than the prior year, but certainly your taxes were over projection and were over the prior year as well. And your grants were over projection, but under the prior year. As you flip over to the next page, the overriding theme is the general fund was really, there were some ups and there were some downs, there were some overs, there were some unders, but across the board it's fairly consistent. On total revenues, which is shown on page 66, you had a budget of 11.2. You actually brought in revenues of 11.3, so almost dead on projection. And then that compares with about $33,000 higher than in 2012. Going through the expenditure side, just kind of as you just kind of scroll through it with your eyes, the overriding theme, which if you get to page 75, you get to the total expenditure category. Basically, every department came in modestly under budget, so nobody over expended their budget. And most spent a little bit more than the prior year, with a couple of exceptions. Public Safety and Public Works actually spent a little bit less than in 2012. And so on the total expenditures, which is shown on page 75, you have a budget of 10.9. Actuals came in at 10.3, so again, underspent by roughly $500,000. And again, that compares with about $100,000 less in total than was spent in 2012 before any transfers, PILTs, subsidies, or other items that are shown on page 76. You do have transfers in and transfers out in the general fund. The transfers in, the $194,000, is primarily payment in lieu of tax that was charged out to the enterprise funds. And then the $488,000 transfer out, the bulk of that was a $367,000 transfer that went to the capital projects fund. The actual transfers themselves, and I didn't mark the page, but the transfers themselves are detailed in the footnotes as well. So if there's a question about where a transfer went, that is detailed in the footnotes. So I'm going to kind of bypass some of the smaller funds and then go to page 95. And we're going to kind of look at the enterprise funds a little bit. Page 95 is the asset section of the Water and Sewer Enterprise Fund. Again, I think I already made the comment about, you know, cities are tend to be very infrastructure heavy, particularly enterprise funds, water sewer operations, a lot of water lines and sewer lines, a lot of infrastructure to run it. So that having been said, the net property and equipment at $49 million in this fund represents about 95% of the total assets for this fund. That is not unusual for an enterprise fund, but again, it just goes to show that it is very, very capital intensive. And this fund does have positive cash, roughly $500,000. Again, pretty consistent, static from the prior year. Over on page 96, you know, liabilities, some were a little bit up, some were a little bit down. This fund, the Water Sewer Fund, does have a pretty significant amount of long-term debt, a little over $2.2 million when you include the current and the long-term portion. Those are primarily your low-interest loans from the State of Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. A great interest rate, 1.5%, but you do have, you know, $2.3 million of debt that does come due with the payment schedule. And the payment schedule is actually shown on footnote 7, which is on page 41. I'm not going to flip back there, but again, it gives you a visual cue of, you know, what our upcoming debt service obligations will be on that page. Page 97 is the income statement for water and sewer. You did have about a 2% increase in revenue and came in a little bit better than projected in the budget. On the expense side, again, I don't know when I've seen a financial statement that was more just stable. I mean, really, really stable. If you look at 2011 cost $811,000 for the water fund, $816,000, very little movement at all in your total cost. So, and in total, total expenses, which are actually shown over on page 98, I think your total expenses are actually down a little bit from the prior year. So your revenues went up 2%, your actual cost declined just a scotch. So your income operating before depreciation, operating income before depreciation, in the positive $489,000. To me, on this particular page, that number is very critical because it tells me right out of the gate what I charged my users and my hard costs, my day-to-day, you know, payroll and utility costs and office supplies and maintenance and repairs are being fully covered and fully funded by the user charges. And in addition to that, you have some debt service, which was about just under $200,000 for the year. So you not only covered the day-to-day operating expenses, but also covered debt service, and you're still in the positive. However, bring in the depreciation factor, $1.6 million, and your actual operating income becomes an operating loss of $1.1 million. And again, I kind of already mentioned the, you know, just philosophically, should the user charges and should the rates be sufficient to cover all that depreciation hit? Again, that's kind of a policy decision, and certainly it varies around the state as to how people feel about that. But to me, like, the critical element is, did you cover your day-to-day hard costs as well as your debt service? And this fund did. So that's good. If you flip it over to page 99, a few other ins and outs. You did have some capital contributions. Capital contributions basically being capital grants that go right into that infrastructure. A transfer out, 120, again, primarily that's a payment in lieu of tax. So for a net change in net position, $463,000 to the negative, again, including that big chunk of depreciation. page 101, then, we have the Airport Enterprise Fund. And in this particular fund, kind of the same quick high-level analysis, 99% of the assets in this fund are infrastructure. It's basically the improvement, you know, airport improvement property at $7.7 million. There was no really significant changes in the liability side. Again, the airport does have the advance of 240. That's up a little bit from the prior year. And then in the net position or the equity section, we did end the year in total net positive of 7.2, which includes all the capital and infrastructure. But on a spendable level, the deficit did grow just a little bit to end the year at $482,000 in the red. And you can see why did that happen? So page 102, revenues came in at $140,000. Expenses came in before depreciation. Expenses came in at $247,000. So even before taking into effect, you know, your depreciation costs, this particular fund, the revenue streams, the leases, you know, the tie-down fees, they're just simply not covering the cost of doing business out there right now. So we did have an operating loss, 107 before depreciation, operating loss of 602 after depreciation. Again, taking into effect some minor capital contributions and a subsidy transfer in of 70,000, this fund actually had an overall net loss of $537,000.
So now, so this net loss is, it's, this is an enterprise fund. So where is that coming from?
Right now, the fund itself has a deficit equity position. And to the extent that the city operates a central treasury for cash concept, it has borrowed money from the treasury.
Mm-hmm. And is that reflected? So how are we going to make that up, and when do we make that up?
Well, that's a good question. So where we're at right now, the fund has a deficit. What does that mean? Well, it has a deficit because for a number of years, the fund has had losses. It's accumulated losses mm-hmm. over a period of time. So where you're at right now, and again, I was mentioning this to the city manager right before this meeting, it's kind of a simple mathematical equation. We can either increase revenues or we can cut costs to the extent that we can actually come into a net positive, like an actual income, positive income, or we can figure out some way to forgive some of what's been borrowed, AKA through a general fund transfer to forgive some of it, or from another fund. Right now, the decision is kind of in your court at this point. This is where it is. It's accumulated a deficit. The idea is, what are we going to do to remove the deficit? So we can either increase our revenue stream, we can cut our cost, or we can find some way to subsidize, whether that's through forgiveness via the general fund or some other tax base, or an ongoing, some kind of ongoing payment plan.
Mr. Manager.
No, I wasn't trying to stop you. So, Michelle, can you talk about, is there a time frame that this, let's say that that a council looks at it and says, okay, I recognize there's a debt there, and it may be a debt that's owed from 8 or 10 years. Is there any, either a national standard, accounting standard, or what you've seen is how long would a city keep that kind of obligation on the books?
I don't know that there's a set standard, but there is a rule. And the rule says, when it becomes apparent that there is no way that that fund will ever be able to repay that money, then administratively a decision just needs to be made that it needs to be forgiven and written off through a subsidy or through a transfer. How you get to that point where you make this ultimate decision that there is absolutely no way that this fund is ever going to make that repayment, again, really gets back to there are policy decisions to be made. Have you exhausted all other options and/or possibilities?
from an auditor standpoint, from an account standpoint, what I would like to see, what I think would be the best case scenario, is not a full-on, like, we're just going to forgive it and write it off and do a big transfer, but some type of a, you know, some type, in the world, according to Michelle, you know, there would be some kind of an ongoing payment plan or scheme of, let's increase revenue, let's cut costs, and maybe let's forgive some piece of it slowly over time or have some kind of a payment plan. And as long as you're trending in the right direction, that is, you're trending that the deficit is starting to eliminate, then you're trending the right way, and that's a positive sign. So I don't know if that was a non-answer, but.
Well, hopefully that's an answer that says that we have some decisions to make, and that we have some further discussion that needs to be taking place on this item or anything that's similar to this in other funds, and so we don't let it just go on without being noted. That's what I think is important to figure out exactly when we're going to address it and so on. Councilmember Hanson.
So, Michelle, like in the case of the airport, and it's not going to be the sewer or water, but possibly even the golf course. You see a trend where, you know, expenses are larger than revenue, as in the case of the airport for the last lot of years, 15 plus, right? Is there any reason why it has to be an enterprise fund?
Is the revenue-backed debt, the airport now, the golf course are geo bonds, not revenue-backed bonds? No, there's no reason that it would have to be an enterprise. The case of it, when do you have an enterprise fund? When the policy goal, is to actually establish rates such that they cover costs, that the users support the cost, and the charges the people who are actually using it actually pay for it. That's kind of item number one. But the only category under the accounting rules that says when it's mandated is if there's revenue-backed debt, revenue-pledged, revenue bonds, basically. And if you're not in that category, then it really does become kind of a policy decision.
Mr. Hannon.
So can I ask you then, because I think, is there not an accounting rule, but where you have a federal, like the FAA, paying money that for a capital improvement that requires a match, and then they're in fact putting assurances on it. Doesn't that in fact require a enterprise fund?
If that is the case, I'm not aware of it. I'm certainly, to the extent that the FAA is involved, and you have to definitely follow whatever rules that they've set out. And whether it's an enterprise fund or whether it's a special revenue fund, under those conditions, you would be required to, you know, charge reasonable market rate rents, et cetera, et cetera. I'm not aware that the FAA would require that, but I would actually have to confirm that before I say that with absolute certainty.
So it sounds like the airport needs to charge the golf course more for rent. Anyway.
Let's talk about the golf course in a minute.
Okay.
Can you turn your mic back on?
Oh, I'm sorry.
So sorry. Sorry. Okay, so the airport has a little bit of difficulty. The refuse fund, good news. The refuse fund's in pretty good shape. A very strong cash position. This is page 105. Just over $1 million in cash, and its capital infrastructure is only about 25%. So it's in a very liquid position. It's in good shape there. Unrestricted equity is positive. It did go down a little bit from the prior year, but it's still in very reasonable shape. And then when you look at page 106, operating revenues, your collection fees of $482,000 compared to your hard costs, exclusive of depreciation, at $476,000. So this fund has actually did a really excellent job this year of actually matching, like, what it charged the users covered those day-to-day hard costs. Once you bring depreciation into the equation again, we're back into a little bit of a loss territory, and as well as there is a small pilt. So at the end of the day, the aggregate ending net change was a loss of $63,000. But again, this is one. This fund is not in bad shape, but definitely one you want to kind of keep an eye, because you can see 2012 had a loss, 2013 has a loss. But again, keeping in mind that a big chunk of that is directly tied to the depreciation. And then the golf course, page 108. Basically, again, capital infrastructure, $2 million out of the $2.1 million overall balance. Capital and infrastructure represents about 94% of the assets. We already talked earlier about, if you compare the current liabilities to the long-term liabilities, you can see where that reclassification happened, that it was $394,000 deemed short-term, and it's now been reclassified to kind of long-term to get to the $519,000 advance. And then this fund does have an unrestricted deficit of $392,000, which is higher, of course, than, or is more negative than it was in the prior year. Again, page 109, we have the income statement. Your operating revenues at 613, and I don't know how much of this, you know, revenues, the green fees were down in 2013, because the golf course actually brought in less revenue in 2013. Again, how much of that is weather dependent or weather related or management related, or, you know, any number of variables could affect that, but it's not radically different from 12 to 13. So 2013 revenues came in at 613, but the operating costs came in at 655, and that's before taking in depreciation and before taking in debt. So, you know, so this fund definitely, it's not even covering the day-to-day hard costs, let alone the depreciation, which is reflected on the following page. So we ended the year, this fund actually ended the year after paying a PILT, ended the year with a net loss of $143,000. And I'm gonna throw something out there. I hope this doesn't actually get me in trouble. The idea of a PILT and a payment in lieu of tax is actually to make sure that, you know, not only is the general fund receiving revenues that it would otherwise need to be received if those were taxable entities, but it also allows the enterprise fund itself to have a reflection of what the true cost of running that operation is, which if it was a taxable entity, it would have to pay tax. So the idea and the concept of a payment in lieu of tax is perfectly and completely reasonable. For this particular fund, though, again, this might be one of those areas where, as a body, a place to look, if the fund is already not covering its hard cost, so we're already not covering the day-to-day, you know, then we throw a PILT on top of that, sort of just exacerbates the loss in this fund for the year. And so what does that do? Well, by booking the PILT, the enterprise fund reflects it to your cost, and the general fund ultimately reflects revenue that it would otherwise need to receive. But if at the end of the day, the enterprise fund ends up in a loss or can't pay the money back, and the general fund either has to forgive it or whatever, if they have to forgive it, then the general fund still doesn't really get that money in reality. So this is just one other place to maybe look at. The idea of a PILT is excellent in concept, but if the revenue stream isn't covering the day-to-day cost, this is almost, certainly not intentionally, but it almost becomes like a shell game. And I don't mean that in a disrespectful way. It's just, we've moved money from here to there, but this money's in a deficit, just makes this deficit bigger. So just food for thought. All right, and then the last enterprise fund is the land development. It's no activity at all.
Let's just talk. Let's go back to the golf course for just a second. So,
sure.
So we have a negative. We have a net negative again, mm-hmm. And I'm not sure what it was. Oh, there was a 2012.
Yeah, 2012 had a net negative of $152,000. And then 143. It was less of a negative this in 2013.
So anyway.
Yeah.
So again, another place to make some policy decisions as a council.
Yes, I think so.
And so that would probably be a good discussion to have in the budget during, while we're talking about the budget as well. Or sooner, depending on what is advised. All right, very good, thank you.
And then that, so then the last one, the Land Development Enterprise Fund was basically static. It does hold a piece of land that's held for sale and not to be in 2015. Going over to page 116, just a quick again, high level, here we have your federal financial assistance award. And on page 117, the state financial assistance award. And I always like to point out these pages because they really do show just how much the city does rely on grants. So on the federal expenditure side, page 116, the city expended $689,000 in federal grants during 2013. But much more significantly, over on page 117, from the state side, there was just over $2 million in state grants that were managed and spent. And that's not received. That's spent by the city in 2013. And then the last kind of item and page that I like to point out is on page 126. And this is what we call the summary of auditor's results as it relates specifically to the single audit. And in this particular case, all of these no, those are good. But all those no's means no, there was nothing reportable, no, we didn't have any findings to report. And again, for those of you who were here last year, if you can recall, we did have a finding in the prior year. So those findings were resolved in 2013, and we're back to kind of a clean report on the single audit side. So that's kind of a high level in a nutshell. Very quick brief summary again. General fund did pretty, held its own. You held to the budget was pretty consistent with the prior year. The actuals came in, you held to the budget. So on the general fund side, it was pretty good. There's certainly no big gains or big losses there. And then we've already talked at length about the enterprise funds, and you really do have the two funds that are on the watch list. But water and sewer not doing too bad, Buffy's not doing too bad, but definitely air flooring and golf course, things to keep an eye on. And other than that, I'd be very happy to try and answer any other questions.
Councilmember DeVries.
Thank you. You said Gatsby seems to be on overdrive. So is one of the items in the overdrive going to be addressing the depreciation in the enterprise funds?
To my knowledge, there's nothing coming down the pipe. I don't think there's anything coming down the pipe on depreciation, and I don't know if this is a situation that's unique to Alaska, but I suspect it might be somewhat unique to Alaska. And the reason I say that is because Alaska is a state that was built on the government's dime, and more so, I think, than many, many, many other states, because most, if you go to the lower 48, I don't even know how many municipal-owned or operated utilities are out there. Many of them have gone co-op. Many of them have been privately funded. A lot of them are nonprofit in nature. So the depreciation thing, really here, it's kind of almost an Alaskan issue just by virtue of the fact that so much of that infrastructure was not paid for by the ratepayers in the first place. It was paid for by the government. So there's, to my knowledge, no new rule coming down for that. Switching gears, there is a new rule coming for PERS. And it's gonna be ugly. I'm sorry, it's gonna be ugly. So the rule that is coming, I think, is effective for your financial statements December 31, 2015, not this current year that you're in. But it will come into effect for December 31, 2015. And what the rule says is that to the extent that the PERS plan itself has an unfunded liability, then every participating employer, that includes the state, that includes the municipalities, is required to report and record its relative share of the unfunded liability. Now, from a GASB and budgetary perspective, general fund operations, no effect whatsoever. No budgetary impact, no effect on the general fund. And there were a lot of things that went down at the legislative session, and $3 billion or something being put into the fund, but that's not actually happening until 2014. So there's a lot of very specific...
And that's not $3 billion into... That's not $3 billion into PERS. It's PERS and TERS. So there's a significant... I mean, I don't even know exactly how much is being put into PERS, but it's less than what's being put into TERS.
1.9.
Yeah, 1.9. Is that what it is?
For 1.9 TERS, a billion.
A billion. Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, we have our employees are in the retirement system, obviously.
Yeah, so you 1.9?
Oh, okay.
So the accounting rule basically, though, does say you're going to have to record your share of unfunded liability in A, your enterprise funds, to the extent that they have personable employees assigned to those funds, and B, in your government-wide financial statements, the ones that I actually don't love for the record. I'm thinking of the financial statements. But in those statements, you'll have to record it. But you won't have to record it in the general fund, and it won't affect your budget. I think the key thing is, it won't affect your budget has been key to most of my city councils. But the reality is, picking up that liability in your internal enterprise funds, I think it has the very high likelihood of turning all of your enterprise funds upside down on the balance sheet. To even the ones that currently have positive equity, probably will not have positive equity when that liability hits the books. You'll probably land in a deficit. The only thing I can say about that is you're not unique, you're not special. Everybody in the state, same problem. Everyone in the state is going to be pretty much in the same boat. And many of my clients have really strong concerns about this because they're like, well, if I'm upside down in equity, and you know, what's it going to do to my bond rating? And I'm not a bond rating person. You would certainly have to talk to the bond bank or your attorney or your bond counsel about that. But the only thing I can say is everybody, you know, there's an active educational effort out there to make people aware who are not aware. And the reality is, regardless of whether you agree with it or disagree with it or your philosophy about how much your fair share should be, that liability has been hanging out there for a really long time. And this accounting rule, all it's doing is making us put it in writing. The obligation was there anyway. And from this, again, from the standpoint of I'm a bond counsel or a rating agent, that liability and the bill is not coming due and payable immediately. It's certainly something that's going to be paid off over a very long stretch of time based on actuarial accounting, which is not, yeah.
So while it may seem like a good thing that we're all drowning together, we're all still drowning.
Yes.
But we're not alone. But so one of the problems with this, though, is that the state actually is not giving us a number. In fact, the state has told the municipal league and that we don't know how much. We don't really know what that liability is now. I'm sure there's a way to figure that out. So given that this is looming on the horizon and certainly is a obligation that already exists, what is your advice to your clients? Is it for us to do our own internal calculation, or do we sit and wait for the state to come up with and hand something to us and go, oh, by the way, here's your part?
Okay, so firstly, there's...
I'm so sorry. Yeah. So firstly, there's actually two new accounting rules. One is called GASB 67 and one is called GASB 68. And 68 is the one that affects you. And it's the one that goes into effect on December 31st, 2015. GASB 67 is the one that affects the state. And it actually goes into effect a year earlier than yours. So to the extent that you will place reliance on the information provided from the state, the state will be providing the number this year. They will have a number this year. They have to, because their actuarial report mandates it and their audit mandates it this year. So by, and I think the projection that came out of the PERS office was sometime around October of this year, when the audits and the actuarial reports get released, that number will be made public in its quote unquote final form. So they will give you a number this year in 2014.
Do you know that number's going to be a total number, probably? I mean, they're going to say, here's the municipal obligation or something like that. It's not going to say, well, here's Palmer's
obligation.
No, it's
going to say, here's Palmer.
Oh, it is.
It
okay.
is, yeah.
Oh, they are actually going to give that to us this year?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you said by what time?
I would say before year end, before December. But they're actually they have an audit deadline of like November 1st or something, October 31st.
Okay.
So in order for them to complete their audit, they have to have it done. So I'm thinking, you know, depending on if they had any delays in the release of their audit for any reason, but otherwise it should be done by like November 1st. But I would say certainly by the end of the year.
All right. Mr. Getty.
Madam Mayor, members of council, thank you. A question for Michelle.
Please, go ahead.
Buck Consultants will be conducting the state calculation for the unfunded liability, or who will be doing that?
You know, to be totally honest, I'm not 100% sure on that because they did go out to bid this year for both audit services and actuarial services. And the last time I had any actual correspondence with the DRB, I don't know. Both pieces were out to bid. So I don't know who's doing either piece at this point.
Another question. After Palmer gets his number, how difficult is it to cross-check the accuracy of that number?
Very, very, very difficult, I think.
Okay. Well, all right. Very good. We're at the end of our hour. Are we at wrap up? All right. Anything else you'd like to finish up with?
I do appreciate your business. I'm very happy to still be working with the City of Palmer.
Very good. Thank you very much. With no further business, excuse me. Oh, there it is. Oh, we got motion to.
Yeah.
Sorry. Excuse me. Come
here. Yes. And Madam Mayor, we're out of
TV. Yeah.
Okay.
Here, isn't it? Oh. All right, we're out of the committee of the whole. I mean, out of the committee of the whole, and we have a motion to approve the 2013 City of Palmer audit.
Second.
Made by Councilmember Hansen and seconded by Councilmember Combs to a motion to approve 2013 City of Palmer audit. Is there any further discussion? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, say no. All right. So the audit has been accepted unanimously, and it's approved accepted unanimously. And that brings us to our final audience participation, a time for anyone that would like to come forward to address the council for up to 3 minutes, 5 minutes if you are representing a group. Audience participation is now open. Seeing no one come forward, audience participation is now closed. And unless there's opposition, I will skip council member comments and with no further business before the council at this special meeting, we are adjourned. We'll take about a 5-minute quick break and be back for our regular meeting.